Hail there! What ship is that? This is the good ship Outrig with another one of Jim Brown's Caper Casts. This is number 23, and Christy has been bugging me to talk about my older son, Stephen. I have told you about my trip in Russell's Proa from Bermuda up to Martha's Vineyard. People seem to like that one. It's one of my favorites. But for Stephen, I can think of a couple of stories. One of them is, I've written about them both. One of them is about our time spent together out in a very remote corner of the earth in the Central Pacific, trying to teach Polynesians how to build outrigger canoes. And the other one happened much earlier, maybe the early 70s, that is kind of heavy and very personal, but I feel like I should tell you that one first. This is all about family cruising and the relationships in the family when they're all confined to a cabin about the size of a Volkswagen microbus. We were cruising down the western seaboard of Central America, and we really loved our 4 months in Mexico. But as we were crossing to Guatemala, I came down with hepatitis, and we had to stop there, move ashore for months. And the circumstances under which we entered Guatemala were quite something. I should tell you about that. To get to Guatemala from Mexico, one has to cross the dread Gulf of Tehuantepec. Now, bear in mind that by the time you get this far south, the isthmus is actually running more east and west than it is north and south. So, on the west side of the Gulf of Tehuantepec, there was a tiny little Indian village. That little bay there is called Huatulco, and it's now the site of a giant Mexican resort. But when we were there in 73, the little village had a population of only about 100 people. But the bay was an ideal place to hide while waiting for the weather to give a break in the Gulf itself. So when we arrived at Huatulco, I climbed the mast and with the binoculars, and I could see out onto the Gulf of Tehuantepec, and the whole thing was just nothing but teeth sticking up. There was a terrible gale blowing out there, and at Huatulco, it was calm. It's a situation wherein the wind pressure piles up in the Caribbean and squirts out through the mountain passes onto the Pacific side with a Venturi effect. So the Gulf of Tehuantepec is a terrible place at the wrong time. But we were able to hang out there for at least a week in the little bay at Huatulco, waiting for it to lay down. And during that time, we just happened to be there for an Indian festival. The people of Chiapas, the very southern state in the country of Mexico, are mostly Maya Indian. And they come down to Huatulco once a year to, as they say, celebrate the waters. It's at the end of the dry season, and they're all praying for rain. So we watched the population of that little village grow to about 5,000 for that long weekend. It was an incredible influx. And the first thing they did was to build a jail, a log stockade for putting unruly people for this big party. It was also a huge marketing event. That is, vendors from all over southern Mexico would come down for this festival in order to sell everything from household goods to textiles, animals, everything. Truckloads of stuff, and it was amazing how these little thatched shelters, palapas, would spring up all over the place in order for people to set up their booths for marketing their wares. There were generators, lots of very loud music, and hawkers. Oh, my. Of course, several little beachfront bistros popped up. So, of course, we became patrons. We were sitting around there at some crowded tables drinking with the locals. And there were a couple of burros running loose through the bistros. And one, a female, was in heat, and the other, a male, was chasing the poor gal right through the festivities. You know, clippity-clop and hee-haw and people screaming, knocking over tables. They finally got a hold of the male and tied him up to a bush out in the direct sun. The poor guy stood there with his dong dangling on the ground, blown by flies, braying away pathetically. And it was, you know, just part of the fun. Oh my gosh, I may have told this story before in a caper cast. If so, I can't find it, so please excuse me if I'm repeating myself. But anyway, after the weekend, the crowd dispersed, and I climbed the mast again and looked out on a calm sea. We actually motored across the Gulf of Tamaulipas, our little 4-horsepower outboard buzzing away in a calm. But it can be a terrible place, no doubt, as illustrated by one of the telephone interviews that I have done with Joe Farinaccio, with my client Fred Yates, who tells the survival story of how he and his wife lost their boat in the Gulf of Tamaulipas from a terrible gale that got blown hundreds of miles to sea. Anyway, as we approached the Guatemalan side of the Gulf, I was feeling really peaked. We didn't know why, but we did know that we had to enter the country of Guatemala by an open wharf that stuck out for miles in the raging sea. At that time, Guatemala had no other railhead port on the Pacific side. We knew I had to get to a doctor. So we anchored off that wharf, and we watched a ship being loaded by lighters coming and going from the wharf. A little tug was dragging these lighters in and out, loaded with cotton bales, and it looked like a pretty desperate situation at the wharf. The lighters were being crashed into the wharf continually by a surf raging through. There was no way we could go to the wharf. Finally, the tug came to us. I shouted across, "Enfermo, sick!" And after a few minutes, the cry came back from the tug in English, "Hey, bring your papers here!" So we made up a packet of passports and crew lists and stuff, and the tug skipper managed to back his vessel in close enough to mine so that using a long pike pole, we could pass that packet across to the guys on the stern of the tug. They examined the papers for a while. Then I managed to explain to them that I had jaundice of some kind. My eyes were yellow eyes. So they backed the tug in again, and with the help of the boys and two guys on the stern of the tug, I got passed over onto the tug and taken to the end of the wharf, where, with a great deal of assistance, I was passed up onto one of the lighters, and it was heaving around in the swell, banging against the wharf. I couldn't stand. The next thing I knew, down from above on a little derrick came a great big oaken office chair, hanging by a bridle. They plopped me in the chair, two other guys hung on to the chair, and we were elevated up onto the wharf by a little donkey engine that was going pop, pop, and throwing sparks, and I was led into a warehouse where there were guys running around in these big white cotton suits with hats and red sashes, just like right out of the movies, wheeling around bales of cotton. And a couple of customs agents, the aduana, led me down the wharf. It was a long walk, looking down onto miles of breakers. We came to the inland end of the wharf, where there was a great gap, well, about 2 feet wide, and you could see that the wharf was moving. It was not wise to get stuck in that gap, so the guys stepped across the gap, reached over and grabbed me, hauled me across, and smiled and saluted and said, "Welcome to Guatemala." I was blown away. But I had left my wife and family on the boat, bobbing in the swell just outside the surf line, with instructions that if I didn't come back in a couple of days, they were to continue on to Costa Rica, and I would meet them in Punta Arenas. We would communicate somehow with the help of the Guatemalans. And anyway, I got to a doctor. The guy took a urine sample, swashed it around in a white enamel tray, looked up at me gravely. The pee was the color of coffee. He said, "Hepatitis, go to your room. Don't move, don't think, 6 weeks. Well, with the help of a great friend, a Guatemalan, who had had one of my boats, his name was Art Herberger, and in the end, he actually opened up the country for us. But we did book a room at a little resort just for Guatemalans that was not far down the coast, and I got back to the boat that night, with the instructions that the next day I was to sail down the coast just a couple of miles to the entrance to a river bar at a place called Likin, L-I-K-I-N, Likin or Likin. We were told to wait for high tide and then shoot a madly breaking river bar in order to get in to a big lagoon behind the beach. Well, we found the place the next morning, all right, and we waited for high tide. Bounding around outside the surf line, the boys who had done some surfing were keeping a close eye on the waves coming in, and as the sets passed under us, I could feel it really picking up the boat, and looking beachward, we could see that there were just terrible breakers occurring when the waves felt the bottom. But by this time, I was really pretty much down to hands and knees. It seemed we should risk it. So the boys called the shots. "Not this one, Dad. No, not this one." We let a great big one roll under us and break, and then go for the beach with our little 4-horsepower outboard. Bzzz. And we now encountered perhaps the scariest moment in the whole trip. We made it past the break line all right without encountering a big crest, but behind us came the swash of what was left of a really big boomer. We were inundated with spindrift. The boat instantly turned sideways, was swept sideways for, I don't know, it seemed like a quarter of a mile. Da-da, 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 along we went, totally out of control, hanging on. Presently arrived at the beach, having actually missed the river mouth. The boat went aground, but then the heave from another big wave picked us up, and the tide was still running in, and it just flushed us into Guatemala. Man, were we ever glad to get out of the ocean. Here we were in a jungle paradise, and I just wanted to get off of the world for a minute. So I turned the boat toward the beach on the river bank, ran her aground, and we had time to sit there and catch our breath only for, I swear, it wasn't a minute. And I'm not making this up. 6 Guatemalan soldiers with guns hopped out of the jungle, jumped on the boat. We froze with panic. 2 of the guys went down below, started searching through the cabins. They were opening up our cereal boxes. It didn't take them long to figure out that we were just a gringo family in distress. My Spanish was still pretty lame at that time. But they got us to this little cement block bungalow resort, patronized only by Guatemalans. We tied up at a dock. The kids stayed on board. Joanna and I moved into a little cubicle. I stretched out on a cot underneath a ceiling fan and stayed there for a week. The boys stayed on board. We took our meals, most of them in the little restaurant, mostly beans and rice, which was delicious. And Art Herberger made a deal with a little Indian guy with a machete to bring me every morning 10 drinking coconuts. He said that when the local fellows get hepatitis, they don't even stop working. They just drink half-ripe coconuts. So, oh my, I guzzled that stuff all day, and it went through me twice as fast as beer. And in about a week, I was ready to go. Art Herberger took us the 250 miles up into the mountains to Guatemala City, where we bought an old panel truck, went back to the boat, moved most of our stuff into the truck, left the boat anchored within easy gunshot range of a little bridge that crossed over to an island upon which was located the Likin Resort. There was a guardhouse on the bridge. The guard said that for $5 a month, there would be no worries. Anybody fooled around with our boat, and he would just shoot 'em. Well, we soon settled in a little mountain town, Antigua, Guatemala, way up in the highlands, where we rented a groovy pad and went to school to study Spanish. Stephen and Russell were, I guess, 12 and 13, and as soon as they picked up a bit of the language, they made friends with the locals, and we were all just having a wonderful time. We were so lucky that I got sick because it forced us to stop. We stayed there for 8 months, traveled all over the country in our truck. Perhaps another caper for another cast. But when we got back on the boat, it was clear that the boys had grown in many ways, and we felt quite confined. It was remarkable, really, that a family of 4 could get along in a little boat like that. but we were being plagued by what they call sibling rivalry. It sure helped to stop and get ashore for a while, so we enjoyed Costa Rica by traveling overland to the Atlantic side. And yet the anchorages on the Pacific side were just dreamy. It was like a tropical California. And when it came time for us to head for the Panama Canal, we began hearing stories about how difficult it was to beat across the Gulf of Panama. You know, the isthmus down there actually runs east and west, so the canal actually runs north and south. And the Caribbean is typified by high pressure. The Atlantic trades are actually blowing in all the way from Africa, so both the water and the air pile up in the Caribbean. But the wind now pours through gaps in the mountains and blows out across the Gulf of Panama with the Venturi effect, and it can be fierce. So I was looking for some local knowledge or some seasoned advice, and was able to find an old sea dog who had made that passage several times. And he told me about Punta Mala, Bad Point. It's a major promontory and defines the Gulf on its western side. And he told me not to try to round Punta Mala in the afternoon. He said, wait until late evening when the wind lets down and get your boat set up for a heavy thrash to windward. And he also told me, whatever you do, don't try to round Punta Mala and beat up for the canal itself. Put your boat on the port tack and stay there until you get over onto the South American side. He said the wind causes quite a current to circulate in the Gulf of Panama, and you'll be beating not only against the wind, but against the current if you try to tack up to the canal. So with this urgency at hand, the boys called a truce in their bickering. So we got all reefed down and cleaned up, rested, fed, and we headed out into what became a beautiful nighttime gale moonlight on a very lively liquid crystal ocean. So we traded off the helm right through the night, keeping dear old Scrimshaw in the groove, fairly jumping from one white horse to another. One tack, one course, and just before daylight, we could see the mountains of eastern Panama. Hey, South America, here we come. Well, by late morning, we were in close and could see that this escarpment was really like Big Sur, but crowded with Tarzan jungle. A very steep coastal slope, but we found a little cove put into a place called Bahia de Pinas, Pineapple Bay, where we could clean up and get some rest. Well, we resolved to leave again that night and head for the canal, so we needed rest. Joanna and I had just settled our brains for a long summer's nap when up in the forepeak there arose such a clatter. It was the boys. They had taken up arms again, and we were tired of it. And we understood that they were each just trying to establish their identities and find their rung on the ladder. And Stephen, the elder, was apparently threatened by Russell, who was growing fast and nipping at his heels. And this tension was manifested into Stephen becoming the aggressor and trying to kick Russell back down a rung or two. And unless the vessel was actually underway, this vendetta was relentless. Well, at some point I saw Red went charging up into the forward cabin, Joanna hollering, "No, stop!" But Steve and I had an honest altercation, did slap him around. And in the process, of course, I hit the chimney on his kerosene lamp. It crashed to the floor. It cut the scene, and after cleaning up, I retired into a fit of real remorse. I said to Joanna, "Those kids are ruining our trip." And she said, "What do you expect of them cooped up in that little cabin?" Well, I squirmed until about 11 o'clock that night when I dragged everybody up and we headed out. Starboard tack now, very little wind under the mountains. I remember I think we motored for a while. I think the boys crawled back into their bunks. Joanna steered while I had a close look at the chart. We had deep water around, so I set a course for the Perlas Islands, a cute little archipelago right in the approaches to the Panama Canal. A gentle katabatic wind was coming down off of the mountains. The moon came up, and we set sail with the big Genoa. The boat started gliding along, and Joanna, too, retired. I took the helm. We had no self-steering or autopilot in those years. I hoped that Stephen was asleep, despite his swollen lip, and I was alone in the cockpit with my aching soul. And the next thing I knew, we had sailed into the fog. It wasn't dense, and it was kind of patchy, and it wasn't deep. The moonlight was coming through it from above. We were not yet in a traffic area, at least not yet. We would be tomorrow. Even though I couldn't really see where we were going, I felt fairly secure letting the boat glide along on a reach in 6 or 7 knots. I was trying to enjoy the ride while musing about how far we'd come and all that we'd come through in our family lives afloat. And now here we were getting ready to change oceans. I was going back to the Caribbean, something I'd been trying for the past 18 years. You know, it was back in the 50s when I was building my little nugget and dreaming of going back to Panama and the Caribbean. I was dreaming of being footloose and fancy-free with pals and gals and islands and oceans. But before I had the boat quite finished, I bumped into Joanna. And of course, we couldn't get enough of each other, and the next thing I knew, I was a family man. Trying to fabricate a career as a yacht designer, hunch over the drafting board for hours and years. Well, pretty soon the breeze came on, and we were moving pretty good. The fog seemed to have mazes in it. You could see this way and that down through tunnels, all defined by walls of glowing mist. Sometimes they were open at the top, and I could catch a peek at the stars. And I thought, man, this is really special. I should call them up and let them see this scene. I began to feel quite lucky. I mean, after all, both of my kids and my wife were willing to buy into my trip. But I seldom had the chance to enjoy the cockpit and the boat on my own. So I decided, what the hell, let them sleep. And let me be here, perhaps my favorite place on earth, and really in the now. That's the way it is with sailing. When things are really going right, boy, you're not thinking of anything else. So I gazed around and noticed that in places the moon was shining down through big holes in the tops of fog tunnels. It came through in big formless shafts to illuminate the surface of the sea, and depending on where this happened, relative to the shape of the waves there, the ocean might go all aglitter for a while. It looked like hammered pewter, but brightly polished, while the hammering was going on. But it wouldn't last, because the holes in the fog were moving and opening up more tunnels with maybe a little glitter at the end. Well, I began to feel a little better. I thought, what the hell, this is what I came for. I'd been mortified with guilt for assaulting my son, but began to realize that guilt was good for nothing. It wasn't going to help with patching things up with that boy. But how was I going to do that anyway? How could I approach him? I should have known that the reality of family cruising would be so much different than the fantasy. And right then it really stretched my mind to try to juxtapose one against the other. And I gave up. This was so much stronger, so much richer, so much different than anything I imagined that we would have to sail through in order to get back to the Caribbean. We were even going to sail through a mountainous isthmus, and that's another story for another caper cast. But in the meantime, let them sleep, I thought. This is about as good as sailing gets, and it's mine. Now there were big patches of starry sky overhead. The moonlight was pouring down and the wind was piping up. And taking an enormous chance being on deck alone, I rigged a boom vang and a barber haul. Of course, I had to leave the helm in brief moments, and if I had fallen over, there'd be no way anyone could pick me up. I knew I was being really selfish, but what the hell, this ride was mine, and I really had her going now. I knew I should call my crew and shorten sail, but instead I hunkered into the forward corner of the cockpit and wrapped one arm around the lower shroud so that I knew I could not be dislocated. Because of my long arms, I could still reach the tiller, and it was really talking to my left hand. And it said, "See, I've been trying to tell you, you don't even know me yet." And suddenly, there was another voice. It was Stephen, speaking to me through the hatch. He said, "Hey, Dad, can I steer?" Oh, it was such a shock. It sent a book-length flash through my head. A million thoughts. And the one that made my throat cramp up was, "My God, you mean after last night, he wants to come up and sail with me?" His face was framed there in the hatch. I could see his swollen lip, but he had his jacket on. I couldn't speak. And it's a good thing, because I think what I tried to say was, "Gee, Steve, I don't know, we're really on the edge. I don't think this is a good time." But what a deflating thing that would have been for him. So after gulping for a while, I finally said, "Okay, Steve, I'll slide back. You sit here. Grab the lower shroud and just watch her go for a minute. Then I'll give you the helm." Well, I knew enough not to watch him. I faced aft and watched the wake, and it waggled a bit at first, but pretty soon he had her in the groove. He said something like, "Wow, Dad," and I said, "I'll ride shotgun on the Genoa sheet. You just steer to make her go." So he did that rather well, I thought, and we just sailed along together. Oh, did we sail along. I think it had never been better between us, and ever since it's never really gotten bad. So much for trying to be a father and a captain and a husband and all that other stuff. But we came through the heavy weather. Not every family does. I'm not saying we did it well, but we did it. And, of course, we had some unforgettable capers along the way. I'm a bit wrung out over that one. But I want to mention that our very patient publisher has put a page for us on Patreon. Oh, God, that's awful. It's where we plead for peanuts. Sorry, we've got to have some fun with this. Yeah, Patreon is one of those crowdsource funding deals where you can only hope you, where you can only hope you got a lot of people putting up a little bit of money so you can cover caper casting costs. There. But to manage that, of course, we have to let Patreon get their sticky fingers in your pocket every month. That makes me feel uneasy, but I'm told it's very secure. And you can believe that your participation, in whatever amount, is going toward the CaperCast. If I can take this thing to a new level with some real field interviews and perhaps some real sailing action underway, it's going to involve some travel costs and equipment costs. And that's what we're asking you to cover. Now, of course, there's a whole lot that we want to do with the Outrig project overall. And for that, we're frankly looking for an angel, or someone who just might detect an investment opportunity in the resources of the Outrig collection, all this history and lore that we've been gathering for 20 years. And incidentally, much of it is already professionally archived at the Mariners Museum in Newport News, Virginia. Now, for that, we're not pleading for peanuts. Of course, to participate on that level, one does not go to Patreon. That's the distinction between the angel and the crowd. So if you would consider helping us apply the resources of the Outrig collection by, for instance, logging it into a database, which would be a huge undertaking, but then we could make it accessible to anyone, and it would be organized for use in making something like a documentary film on modern, lightweight seafaring. There's a big story there, and I'm just here telling parts of it. So if anyone is interested in backing a granddaddy caper, please drop me an email with your phone number. We can talk about it and try to arrange a meeting. Boy, Christy just hates this stuff. I'm surprised she isn't twisting my ear. But I guess she knows which side her boat is buttered on. And I confess to be a bit spent by making our shameless pitch. So I'll go away now, but with the promise that next time, I'll tell you about our greatest one-day boat ride ever, sailing through the Panama Canal. That's right, sailing. Okay, bye-bye.